Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Just how big is the nation's mortgage-rooted economic crisis? And how did we create a system where unprecedented wealth was created in real estate just a few years in time and then lost within a matter of months? As part of KERA's year-long project on the economy, this is a special edition of Think. And my guest is Alyssa Katz, a journalist who writes for Mother Jones, The Big Money, and New York magazines, among others. Her new book outlines how it all went down and explains the many elements that played into our current state of affairs. The book is called Our Lot, How Our Real Estate Came to Own Us. Alyssa, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
In 2006, at the height of the housing boom, you looked at the city of Cleveland, Ohio, and found a sort of canary in a coal mine. Can you talk about what was happening there?
Sure. And I have to say, I kind of stumbled on it by accident. I had no idea that foreclosures were beginning to ravage entire neighborhoods in Cleveland. I was simply looking at data that I had requested from the Mortgage Bankers Association just to see, in the middle of this real estate boom, if there were any signs of cracks on the horizon. And sure enough, looking at Ohio, I saw that that state had a foreclosure rate triple that of the rest of the country, the national average, and that subprime mortgages were going into foreclosure at a rate of 13% of all mortgages. And this was just astounding. And I just simply wanted to know, well, why was this happening? What was going on here? And how could lenders continue to put mortgages out there if they were failing at such tremendously high rates? So Mother Jones magazine sent me to Cleveland to tell the story and find out. And I have to admit that at the time, I did not know what a mortgage-backed security was. I didn't know they existed.
You were not alone, I think, at that point.
That's right. But simply to explain, well, how was it that financial institutions could again and again go out there and produce loans that would go into foreclosure within a couple of years? I had to piece it all together and figure it out, and that led me to write the book Our Lot.
Yeah, and part of what you discovered was that mortgage companies could afford to be losing big money in a place like Cleveland because everything else was sort of carrying the tide.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, the investment banks that package and sell mortgage-backed securities are extremely sophisticated in exactly how they engineer these what are essentially giant pools of hundreds of mortgages. And they spread out the pools geographically to make sure that no more than 5% of any given pool is from a particular state. And they do this exactly because you can have a bust in a certain geographic area because of the economy. In fact, Texas had such a bust in the 80s, and it was really became a big problem. So these products were engineered to minimize the risk for investors, but it meant that an individual place would suffer potentially enormous risks if a lot of foreclosures were concentrated there, and that was what was happening in Cleveland.
Well, and one of the negative outgrowths of doing things this way is the fact that mortgages are not very often written locally anymore. They're not done by the local bank that's 2 miles away from a house or a neighborhood. They are very often completely removed from the places where they are making these loans.
That's absolutely right. I mean, the entire mortgage-backed securities system was designed to take investors' funds from anywhere in the world and channel them into the pocket or into the house of any mortgage borrower anywhere. And this is a system deliberately engineered to channel as much money as possible into housing and real estate. And this is completely different than what had existed before the 1980s. Basically, this system was created by the Reagan administration and Congress to really solve a big problem that had existed then, which was that money for mortgages was drying up, interest rates were extremely high, there was a huge credit crunch then, and mortgage-backed securities were the solution. But until the early 1980s, most mortgages were financed directly by local institutions, especially savings and loan institutions, that would use the funds they had in their deposits from customers and then turn around and lend that money out. And, they might, those savings and loans might then go and sell those mortgages to Fannie Mae and get more funds that way. But it was still a very local economy, and often the financial institution and the customer would have an existing relationship with one another.
And the lender had skin in the game, as we say.
Absolutely. The lender absolutely did have skin in the game, because if a mortgage didn't perform, I mean, Fannie Mae would send it right back and say, what are you giving us? Because the mortgages were kept whole. They weren't, as would come to happen later, sliced and diced into thousands of pieces. And it really made it impossible for mortgage security pools ultimately to go back and put all the pieces together again once mortgages went into foreclosure.
So anyone who's bought a home in the last decade is aware of this, that in fact you get your loan through one bank, and by the time you leave the title company, you've got a piece of paper that tells you you're going to pay someone else. Can you talk about how the banks really didn't have to be that concerned about the long-term viability of these mortgages, because they very often, these things sort of vanished from their control within hours after they were written?
Right. We have to be careful. Even when you're saying banks, most of these institutions making the mortgages were not even banks at this point.
Yeah.
They're just, often it was mortgage lenders that only did this kind of business. And in fact, such companies often were those that took the greatest risks, because they absolutely were passing along the mortgages to investment banks and other financial companies that would then take them, package them for sale to investors, and then get them out in the marketplace. And at that point, it was the investors who carried all of the risk. Lenders didn't have to worry about that. I mean, in theory, and this is all in the fine print of the contracts that they signed with the investment banks, if loans didn't perform the way they were supposed to, that is, if there had been any fraud and in the statement of how much the property was worth or the income or of the borrower, or if anything about the making of the mortgage wasn't what it appeared to be, in theory, the bankers could send it back to the lender and say, no, this is no good. But in practice, often by the time that the investment banks figured out that mortgages had gone bad, the lender had shut up and shut down and gone out of business. Mm. This happened again and again during the 90s. I mean, this is not a new phenomenon.
So in 1983, these changes were made to how mortgages could be securitized. Can you talk for a minute about who started investing in these things that seemed like a golden and very secure opportunity?
Absolutely. And, the mortgage-backed securities were deliberately engineered to be as attractive as possible to as many investors as possible. And it is really a creation of genius in that sense, because when you think about what a home mortgage is, it is a 30-year commitment, and it's as a borrower, you pay your bills month after month after month for 30 years. Now, for an investor who wants to get a piece of that action, that's an extremely slow and risky way to make money. You have to wait 30 years to get paid back, and something might happen to the borrower or the house or whatever along the way. So mortgage-backed securities were able to also create very short-term investments out of that by mortgages, by pooling them together and slicing up interest in that pool, and investors who needed to get in and get out have very low risks and find ways to invest in real estate suddenly could. So now there were just huge new institutional investors coming into the market, especially pension funds, savings and loans, and other banks. Suddenly they could invest in mortgages on a massive scale. And, you also had, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which themselves, these are government-sponsored entities that themselves could also create and package mortgage securities, but they could also buy financial institutions' mortgage-backed securities. So what you had suddenly was the creation of a really massive marketplace. It wasn't massive right away. It took some years for it to really find its footing and figure out how to make money. But once it did, it just took off like wildfire.
So you have all these people who want to invest in mortgage-backed securities, which means there is a ton of money flowing into this, and therefore a ton of money that's flowing back out, and you have homeowners being encouraged to take on these really large loans, and there's even an incentive to inflate property values artificially.
Absolutely. I mean, this all evolved over time, but what eventually happened with the mortgage-backed securities market is that it became very addicted to encouraging homeowners to refinance their homes and sometimes this was to get a lower interest rate, but sometimes it was also to, get cash back, take out a home equity loan, do other things that would tap into home equity. And because so much mortgage money was coming into the marketplace, this is, throughout the 90s and into the early and mid-2000s, home prices began inflating tremendously because it all kind of fed on itself. People would refinance, trade up. Home builders would also set their prices in inflationary kind of ways, and this all became very quickly fueled by this growing amount of debt. And basically, the investors in mortgage-backed securities and the institutions creating these wanted and needed to see this business grow. And by the mid-2000s, pretty much the whole market for mortgage lending, customer base out there in America of homeowners, people who, again, needed to take out a home equity loan, whatever product these institutions were trying to sell, that market was pretty close to tapped out at that point. And the only way to grow then was to really aggressively go after customers who never would have qualified before, and also to give opportunities to older customers to take money out by allowing higher and higher appraisals and just various kinds of risks that would never be in the realm of possibility before.
So you have this new crop of borrowers who would not have qualified under traditional regulations and standards, and you have people who might have had equity in their homes that they have just traded away completely for a big lot of cash that might or might not have been reinvested back in that house.
That's absolutely right. And this is one of the great tragedies of what's happened during the bubble and bust, is that so many of the home buyers who, and many of them were coming in for the first time in the 1990s, there was a big push then from the government, from Fannie Mae, from the mortgage industry to make more Americans into homeowners. And there's a lot of great social and economic reasons that that was an important objective. But because they were coming into this growing marketplace of financial products that was very, very loosely regulated, people would become homeowners for the first time, but have in their lives just very precarious economic situations where if they lost a job or had unforeseen health expenses or all the sort of insecurities that come with just being in the American economy, would have just huge pressures to turn to their home equity for their own economic survival. And so that's exactly what we saw in the 1990s, was that a million Americans refinanced with subprime mortgages, which gave them either cash or some opportunity, let's say, fix a roof, take care of basic needs, but also just through high interest rates and high fees, drain their equity incredibly quickly.
And that would have been okay if home values had either stayed stable or continued to increase, but that's not what took place.
Exactly. I mean, this whole system depended on rising home prices, and this is true for the borrowers, true for investors, and true for lenders. Because anyone who got into trouble with paying a mortgage while prices were rising could get out, and often would get out ahead. And I have people I interviewed for my book who had exactly that situation, and even homeowners who didn't have that happen to them themselves knew somebody who had that experience. And I think that general trend really encouraged a lot of very risky behavior, because people thought, oh, this is what you do. You go out, you take out, you stretch as far as you can, you take out really more than you can afford, but it's okay because the property will increase in value and you'll come out ahead and have money in your pocket. I mean, who wouldn't want that?
Alyssa Katz is my guest. She's a journalist who writes for Mother Jones, The Big Money, and New York magazines, among others. Her new book is called Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think On KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Alyssa Katz, whose new book is called Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. If you'd like to join the conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. So, Alyssa, we had deregulation in the Reagan era. Then in the Clinton administration, we were actively pursuing people who had not traditionally either qualified for home loans or been considered as viable candidates for owning a home. Can you talk about Fannie Mae's sort of campaign to convert renters to buyers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Fannie Mae, in case your listeners don't know, I mean, it had originally been a government agency that was sold to private shareholders in 1968, and ever since then had this funny kind of hybrid existence as both a mission-driven institution that was supposed to spread the possibilities of home ownership as widely as possible, and in fact had a mission to serve low and moderate income people as part of how it was set up in the 1930s, and also to profit for shareholders. And this is, you know, closely regulated by the federal government. And throughout the 1970s and 80s, certainly before that, you know, Fannie Mae had really done an imperfect job of that. It had only really focused on the suburbs, and it was pretty discriminatory. Most of its mortgages went to white suburban home buyers. And it, had never really fulfilled that mandate. And so activists in the 1970s and 80s into the 90s really kept pressing and pressing on Fannie Mae to do something about this. And Fannie, you know, at first resisted, but because the shareholder-owned company needed to grow and because most white suburban Americans at this point were homeowners, something like upwards of 90%, the new leadership at Fannie Mae at the time in the early 90s, James Johnson, he saw in what the activists were proposing an opportunity to build out their market and to do some experiments to see, well, what can we do with how we buy mortgages on a massive scale and help lenders generate money to lend to consumers? What can we change about how we do it to reach into these markets? And I think they really approached it as a very noble social project that happened to be very, very, very good for business. And so Fannie Mae embarked on a $1 trillion pledge. They basically said, we're going to put $1 trillion into turning the nation's renters into homeowners. We want to make as many Americans as we possibly can into homeowners, and we will do what we can to make that happen. To Fannie Mae's credit, it approached this challenge very responsibly and carefully. It, you know, created experiments to see, well, you know, how if we change, you know, how we expect a borrower to prove their income, and they can, you know, if they're a freelancer, let's say they do gardening work and don't get a weekly paycheck from the same employer, that's okay. We'll understand they have different ways of proving their income. And a lot of that is a huge breakthrough, really, really important. But Fannie Mae at the same time just kept pressing and pressing and pressing. And at the same time, it also was getting additional pressure from not only from the activists who've been pressing it all along, but increasingly politically from Congress and the White House, which ended up setting up pretty initially modest, but increasingly demanding quotas for how much low and moderate income lending and lending in urban areas that Fannie Mae had to do. And as this happened, you know, and this, remember, this is all happening simultaneously with the growth of this new subprime industry looking for customers. Increasingly, as Fannie Mae was making new buyers, often moderate-income buyers, into homeowners, those homeowners were also getting sucked into refinances, subprime mortgages, and eventually Fannie Mae began buying investment bank subprime-stocked mortgage-backed securities in order to meet these quotas that Congress had demanded it fulfill.
Let's talk for a minute about some of the things that sort of came in the door separately with the changes at Fannie Mae, some of these solution products that were developed by some subprime lenders. A lot of people have heard of ARM loans, which sort of have a low interest rate for the first couple of years, kind of a teaser rate, and then switch to a different rate. There's also something where people basically make a minimum payment on their mortgage. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's right. That's called an option ARM, and technically it's not the same thing as a subprime mortgage, although there may be subprime mortgages that are option ARMs. But the option ARM stands for option adjustable rate mortgage, and it goes also by different names. But you know, the idea of this is that just like on a credit card where you have the option of making a, quote, minimum payment every month, you know, that minimum payment offered on those mortgage bills is far less than the minimum that a borrower would actually need to be paying to pay off their mortgage in the 30 years they're supposed to pay off a mortgage in. And what that means is that if they keep just making the minimum payment initially, that eventually this debt will just continue to, instead of shrinking as it does with most mortgages, will just grow and grow and grow.
It gets tacked onto the end.
It gets tacked onto the end, and not only that, it's not like one just has to deal with that 30 years later and hopes that they're, you know, have figured out what else to do by then, sell the home or whatever. But once the debt reaches more than 110% of what was initially borrowed or 125%, depending on the mortgage, suddenly all of that, basically the whole amount that the borrower is expected to pay every month jumps up tremendously because they're sort of being put back on track to make that finish making payments in 30 years. So it's an enormous payment shock to borrowers. And one very frightening thing right now is, you know, we're in the midst of this national foreclosure crisis, is that many of these option ARM recasts are coming due right about now. I think a lot of them were expected in August. And you know what this means, especially as we also have rising unemployment, is that a whole lot of families out there are going to be hit with really sharply increased mortgage payments.
Alyssa Katz is my guest. Her book is called Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Cynthia in Plano. Hey, Cynthia.
Hello. I was wanting to hear your guest's opinion on those of us who did responsibly purchase a home before the bubble burst, those of us who got a fixed rate, did our research, didn't buy more than we could handle, and those of us, you know, who not only have a plan to pay it off in the time that the loan is for, but early. I don't hear a lot of people talking about those who did responsibly get into the home market at that time and the negative impact on us.
Yeah, you know, absolutely, and it's a very, you know, tricky situation because, you know, the one reason that certainly that Washington, you know, as well as Wall Street, has paid so much attention to the borrowers who did get in over their heads and did take what one might consider excessive risks or imprudent risks is that the how those borrowers fare has a huge impact on the sort of larger economic crisis that has emerged out of all of this because, you know, as mortgages fail, then financial institutions with a stake in them are also in danger of failing. And so there's just been an enormous, you know, bias and huge amount of money thrown at those borrowers and not a whole lot for everyone else. And, of course, the problem for others, even if you didn't get in get underwater, and that, in other words, owe more than your house is actually now worth. I mean, people are suffering enormous declines in home equity that they have been counting on. So, but I do think that one consolation to keep in mind is that, you know, we have to just accept that some of those home equity gains were illusory. You know, they never were real. They were created through a bubble, a huge amount of debt pouring in, and often outright fraud in stating real estate values. So I think that, you know, people in your situation who acted responsibly just have to take a deep breath in a way, sort of say, you know, it really is terrible and a crime in many cases that people often, for speculative purposes, hoping to make money, did get in over their heads. But, you know, honestly, you know, people just have to weather this storm and really push for policies going forward that make sure that this insane bubble speculation doesn't happen again.
Speaking of speculation, you have some fascinating stuff in the book about this phenomenon of flipping houses, which has become so all-pervasive, or did for a while, that there were TV shows with the name and everything else. You essentially liken that to theft. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's fascinating because, you know, flipping has been around for a really long time. It's not just a product of the mortgage bubble and of subprime lending. And I have accounts of flipping in my book that go back to the early 70s to when the Federal Housing Administration bankrolled just enormous schemes that just left vacant houses littering a lot of neighborhoods around the country. And basically it's this, these operations would emerge that were just purely fraudulent, and they're still getting, just yesterday, I'm in New York City, and the Brooklyn District Attorney just indicted a whole ring of, it involved mortgage brokers and appraisers and lawyers and, realtors and always these what are called straw buyers, these individuals who had decent credit and who, for a very often very small fee, would a little kickback, would agree to take out some massive loan on a property that wasn't worth nearly as much as any of the people involved claimed it was. So basically, the way flipping works is that one party would find a property, usually a really shabby place that no one really wants to live in, very, very cheap. And then turn around, and unlike on a lot of the TV shows, where they do, renovations and show off all the beautiful new counters and all that stuff, very often the work on these houses was just incredibly shabby if they did any work at all. And then the first buyer would then turn around and resell the property, often the same day, to another buyer for vastly more money, sometimes two or even three times what the initial buyer had paid for it. And this, of course, required an appraiser to certify that this inflated value was actually real. But because so many schemes were doing this at the same time, often in the same neighborhoods, the appraisers could find what are called comps. They could say, oh, look, right down the street, here's another house that's worth $300,000. Even though, last week the houses were worth $100,000. So it just flipping frenzy just fed on itself. And what's just amazing is that lenders deliberately turned a blind eye to it. Their mortgage brokers out there were the ones signing off on these mortgages, knowing that these properties were being falsely appraised, that the buyers weren't really going to live in the homes. They were just these front people getting kickbacks and all of this stuff. But because it was bringing loans into the system and generating fees for everybody along the line, nobody asked questions.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Alyssa Katz is my guest. Her new book is called Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. Let's go next to Arlington and speak with Ed. Hello, Ed.
Hi. I applaud Ms. Katz's reporting on this issue in general, and I'm anxious to read her book. It sounds wonderful and amusing to this dedicated renter. But I do have to take exception to one comment made earlier, and that is about refinancing home as being, quote, okay as long as prices didn't decline or were continuing to increase. I don't think refinancing was ever really okay. In fact, it was illegal in Texas up until the mid-80s when the banking industry finally was able to work over the legislature and get its way and have that provision of the law overturned. The illegality of it, I believe, first came into being during the Progressive era in the early part of the last century. But the logic behind it was that the equity in one's home is what is something along the lines of a parent's obligation to pass on to their children as an inheritance. It's most adults, most Americans, don't really escape the paycheck-to-paycheck struggle until their parents pass on and leave the fruits of their labors to their kids. Their kids didn't ask to be. It was looked at as the fact that the kids didn't ask to be brought into this world, and it was kind of a parent's obligation to pass
on. To leave them the house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the banking industry took this, basically stole this from the children, and painted it as being something as socially okay to do, as the trendy, economically hip thing to do, and it was nothing but. So I just wanted to put that into the conversation. I wondered if your book discusses that at all.
It
and
doesn't.
A second, if I could throw in a last question.
Really, really quick, Ed. Thank you.
Does your book compare home ownership in America with the phenomenon, the same phenomenon in Europe, how Europeans handle living?
Okay, I'm going to answer both questions. On the first one, no, my book does not address what you talk about. And from what you're saying and the little bit that I know, that does sound like a serious omission. I mean, I think that refinancing has just become so much part of how the credit industry makes money. I mean, because, again, by 70s and 80s, most of the classic market for home mortgages was tapped out, and it was this constant quest for growth. And as you're saying, just pushing every legislative opportunity and regulatory opportunity to allow growth to happen in ways that hadn't happened before. And that, you know, it's absolutely refinancing, even the fees involved and, you know, various other, penalties that come with doing that can often be really, really harmful. I think one reason refinancing has found such a popular support and widespread support is that in the environment of very low interest rates in the past few years, people were saving enormous amounts of money. And I can't tell you how many friends I have. And I live in New York City where most people rent. But, you know, the people I know who do own would constantly come to me and say, oh, I'm getting this great deal on a refinance. I was paying this, and now I'm only paying that. And so the perception of refinancing has changed tremendously. But I think the issues you're raising are really important. But one other thing I would add to that is that I get very disturbed when I see the federal government actively promoting what are called reverse mortgages, which allow usually an elderly person to basically borrow all their home equity at once, and then when they die, then the home automatically goes to the bank instead of to their heirs. And I just find this abhorrent, and I understand that some elderly people are in financially precarious situations, but you're talking about leaving a legacy for your children. This is just a way, and just another way to steal home equity from people.
And the question about Europe, it doesn't. Do you talk about that?
I do a little bit, not really directly. I mean, I have a chapter in the book about renters, and one enormous difference between the U.S. and Europe is that in much of Western Europe, renters, just as a rule, have various rights and protections that they don't have in the U.S., and especially just basic security in their home to know that at the end of the year, their landlord can't kick them out when the lease runs out, that if the tenant has been a good tenant, that they can go ahead and continue living there. And that's really why we're not seeing the kind of mass foreclosures in Europe, even though they had their bubble there, that we've had here, because being a tenant is okay in Europe, and home ownership has really been the only way to be an American here.
Yeah, we will talk a little bit more about the issue of renting in just a minute with Alyssa Katz. Her new book is called Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also go online to think@kera.org. This is part of KERA's special year-long project on the economy, and we appreciate you joining us. Back in a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Alyssa Katz. Her new book is called Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. You can join us at 800-933-5372. I want to get back to this question of renting. And granted, situations here in North Texas are very different from what they are in New York City. We don't have rent controls here, but we also don't have the kinds of prices for real estate that you have there. But when did we get this idea in most of the rest of the country that renting is sort of a second-class way to live your life?
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting question. I mean, you really have to go back to the 1910s, 20s, and 30s to understand how that came to be. And, you know, this is at a time when much more of the, a greater proportion of the population in the country lived in the North and the Northeast and lived in, often overcrowded city neighborhoods. And at the 19-teens, you had a lot of unrest among tenants who were treated very, very badly generally. Often it was immigrants and it often would become sometimes violent conflict, just very ugly stuff that became a political problem in a lot of cities. And so, over time, you began to get government involved more and more in trying to create other ways that people could live, and is creating home ownership as a mass institution, because we have to remember that until the 1930s, it was rather difficult to buy a home for an ordinary working person because, mortgages, first of all, you had to put down a 50% down payment, and then the mortgage would have to, you would expire in 3 years or 5 years, and you'd have to go ahead and get a new one. But as a result of these government interventions, that it originated in part, I tell the story of Herbert Hoover, who was Secretary of Commerce, started this Own Your Own Home campaign. He was responding, and other business leaders were responding very directly to this sort of history of tenant unrest, but also this possibility that they could build a market not only for buying homes, but for buying, lighting fixtures and furniture and all the things that one puts in homes. And so this is where you really began to see aggressive government efforts to try to encourage people to buy homes, and then eventually that became, after in coming out of the Great Depression, direct financial aid to make that happen, and 30-year mortgages under the Federal Housing Administration, and other efforts that really sought to make home ownership like a birthright for every American. And because of those institutions, especially the Federal Housing Administration, the way they did business was only really to support, to use their insurance fund to support mortgages that they felt were safe. And this was basically meant new subdivisions like Levittown in suburbs. And so this became very much the normal way for Americans to live. And meanwhile, the Federal Housing Administration would not insure mortgages in cities in older urban areas, especially if they were racially, quote, changing, meaning that they had been white and were becoming black, or if they had industry in them and other things that were considered undesirable for a neighborhood. So what this meant was that as mortgage money wasn't available in these places, those people and places became places for renters. One reason that cities have just continued to be for many years places where renting was the predominant thing to do. So you just really saw a huge split in the society between a sort of suburban or overwhelmingly white population that became homeowners because why not? It was so affordable and reasonable and subsidized by the government and all this stuff. And meanwhile, for many, many years also had just vast areas of the country and vast segments of the population excluded from that. And it was always the sort of less desirable people in places that that had that status. So renting kind of gelled as a second-class way of life. And the fact that tenants so rarely have protections, with some big exceptions, New York, in some other places have had rent control in different forms over time, but by and large, tenants really are not, they don't have a lot of rights in the United States. And so just renting has become just a very, very unattractive option that people don't exercise if they have any choice in the matter.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we will speak with David in Mansfield. Hey, David.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thank you.
Great. My name is David, and I want to talk to you about just overall media and perception, public perception on the whole financial crisis due to housing. I used to do mortgage lending for a couple months during the summer, and my comments is that the real problem comes down to consumer debt. The reason why is, as I saw these loans coming through and looking at people's credit reports, it became apparent to me that a lot of these folks were using the house to cover their credit card debt. So what happened is they'll put $10,000 in a couple credit cards between Best Buy or dealers or what have you, and they use that value at home to stretch those payments out longer. So what happens is when they do that, they still don't acquire the discipline to stop or cut those credit cards, and they run those up. So what happens now is their monthly mortgage payments are higher, and they have new additional credit card debt.
That's a good point. Alyssa, do you think that we need to at least take a harder look at consumer behavior?
I mean, absolutely, although you have to remember that this is consumer behavior taking place at the same time that consumers themselves are under a lot of economic pressure. And
sure.
it's so hard to sort of generalize about this stuff because, there's sort of polarized views on both ends. One is that, people would take out home, you know, tap into their home equity to cover credit card debt so that they could buy a nice SUV or, you know, something that they really couldn't afford but pretended that they could afford. And there's, you know, the view that people were just, you know, in desperate financial situations and then would turn to these mortgage products. And there's truth to both of those views. I mean, I think that this is, you know, I think certainly home owners who did tap into their home equity for a lot of life purchases, you know, like in any financial decision, we do have responsibility for our actions, and it's just simply impossible to sort of say, well, this is all the bank's fault, for all the lender's fault for sending up people with these products. But I am just, you know, you just have to look at the total amount of debt that consumers in general have accumulated, really, really driven by mortgage debt, and really dating back to exactly when, you know, getting back to the 1980s again, that Wall Street and the Reagan administration created the new market in mortgage-backed securities. Because, you know, once they did that, once they opened the floodgates to new capital coming in and new financial products that would let borrowers tap into home equity, it, you know, basically the business of selling debt became enormous. And so it's a two-way street. Borrowers took on too much debt, and, you know, mortgage brokers and many other players aggressively peddled it to those borrowers.
We would be remiss in this part of the country if we did not touch on the McMansion phenomenon.
Yeah.
And you've got some really interesting stuff in there about how it is that we went from, I think you said the average homeowner in the United States today lives in an 1,800 square foot house and wants something 30% bigger or something. How we went from that reality to houses that are 4,000 and 5,000 and 6,000 square feet. And part of it is that they don't cost much more to build.
Yeah, which really surprised me to hear that. And I didn't even believe it at first. And I kept asking more people, and they, building, you know, construction supervisors and so on, assured me that this was true. So much of home building, and I don't know the exact situation in Texas, although Texas is home to Centex, right, which is now becoming part of merging with Pulte in Michigan.
Just
to become,
up the street, yeah.
That's right, to become the biggest home builder in the nation. I mean, one huge change that has happened is that home building went from being a predominantly, basically a father and son kind of business run by contractors who sort of became successful local businessmen and tapped into local markets, beginning in the 1990s, in part because of all the availability of mortgage funds and also of construction financing that, you know, that the credit markets were also making widely available, meant that for the first time, home building could become a Wall Street business, something that one could sell shares in to investors and promise reliable returns. Because home building, when you think about it, is kind of unpredictable and unreliable. There's a lot of variables. You don't know if you're really going to succeed and sell everything, you know, that you'd hope to. But it became a mass production machine, and part of that machine, you know, led by Centex, Lennar, many, many other companies around the country that operated in multiple states, was to always push buyers, and first of all, encourage buyers to buy new homes. Don't, you know, why get a home where someone else has sat on that toilet? You can have your own new home, but also to upsize, right? And they had all kinds of strategies, and, you know, that they would use to encourage people to do that, but all driven by the debt products that were available, all driven by the fact that you could say, well, you know, you can get this larger house and then throw in all these extras and options, and it would only cost you this little bitty bit much more per month on your bill.
It sounds almost like when you get sold a car and they don't ask you what you want to pay for the car. They say, well, what can you afford every month? And then suddenly you've got 7 years of payments or something.
Exactly. And in fact, many of the salesmen doing these mortgages came right out of the car business. And it's a lot of the same techniques.
Let's go back to the phones now and speak with Ted in Tyler. Hey, Ted.
Hi. How are you today?
Fine. Thank you.
I guess my question would be, what do you see as the future of home ownership? In the 60s and 70s and 80s, we grew up with the idea that home ownership was a part of the American dream. And so many of us got in school and we strived towards getting to the place where we could financially afford to own our own home. Sounds to me like you're making the argument that renting is not so bad and home ownership is not all it's cracked up to be.
Well, you know, I think doing this book has actually given me, if anything, a lot more respect for what homeownership brings, to this country as an institution. Full disclosure, I grew up as a renter in New York City, so I kind of come at this as an outsider and trying to understand what is such a normal institution for really most Americans. I think, you know, what you're seeing happen right now is the Obama administration in trying to deal with both the economic crisis and sort of what the finance system and mortgages will look like going forward are trying really, really, really hard to keep home ownership really front and center. And for all the right reasons, you know, as an opportunity to own an asset, build something, get ahead. Because really, home ownership has built the American middle class, you know, following World War II. So I think, you know, if home ownership doesn't sort of gets off its throne as sort of the default American way of life, it'll be not because the government has stopped promoting it, because it's in fact doing more and more and more, adding incentives. Like an $8,000 tax credit you can now get for being a first-time buyer. So they're certainly throwing more money into it, but because prospective buyers themselves shy away and are scared, because that's really the only reason right now that would be the biggest barrier. Certainly a lot of people now have really damaged credit. Mortgage application rejections are going way up, especially for Black and Latino applicants. But for the majority of people, the American dream is still very much a possibility, and declining housing prices are making it in parts of the country, not everywhere, actually for the first time in a very long time, putting home prices within a family's budget, and that's really what needs to happen going forward.
One of the things you think that's critical is that we change financial regulations and make them apply to every institution that might be in a position to make loans to homeowners. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've essentially for the past almost 30 years now had a shadow banking system. Basically, there was a set of financial institutions that we would think of as banks, and they were carefully regulated, and something called the Community Reinvestment Act required those banks to lend fairly, simply to not systematically exclude an entire neighborhood or city because they felt that it wasn't really part of, you know, where they thought they could make the most money, but they would have to be out there making home mortgages. What you had with the invention of the mortgage-backed securities market was simply a virtually unregulated industry. I mean, it was nominally covered by the Securities and Exchange Commission because they were trading these securities to investors, but that was pretty much it. And I think this is what I'm saying is pretty much in keeping what the Obama administration is now asking Congress to do, which is to simply make mortgage finance certainly a much more regulated kind of enterprise. I think the place where I really differ probably a bit from the administration is that I do worry about keeping the bankers who've created such complexly engineered and toxic products before, really keeping them in the driver's seat of funding home mortgages. I really think there does need to be a stronger government role, as there was for many, many years through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that did a great and really responsible job for the most part during all that time. And so I would prefer to see something with a stronger, more regulated hand. But I think overall what we're seeing is a move toward a more comprehensively regulated marketplace.
The new book by Alyssa Katz is called Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. Alyssa, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, thank you.
Support for KERA comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, facing the mortgage crisis as part of CPB's Public Service Media Economic Response Initiative. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.